Good afternoon. I hope you enjoyed lunch, because the next hour and 15 minutes, we are here together to have an architecture lab, a walkthrough around the Windows Azure platform. My name is Kurt Kleis. I work as a TSP, Technology Solution Professional, for Microsoft on the EMEA level. I'm here to answer your technical questions. I'm here for customers to get them onboarded on the Azure platform, to guide them with architectural decisions, to make proof of concepts. That's my role inside Microsoft. So for today, we're here for a presentation about architecture. Who in the audience here is a solution architect or an enterprise architect? All right, see a lot of people. Okay. Who already deployed something with Azure? Who is already developing, building applications on Azure? All right, okay. So the goal of this session is to, well, show you every little piece of technology inside the platform, to talk about it, to show you how it works, to show you some patterns behind it. Okay, let's continue. First of all, we want to position the Azure platform. We have seen already in the previous keynotes, IaaS, PaaS, SaaS, three levels of platforms, while Azure is there for infrastructure as a service and platform as a service. Currently, we're focusing on platform as a service. In the next wave, you will see more focus to the infrastructure as a service. This is the big picture of Azure, the Windows Azure platform. Nice colors, everything is in blue. That's why we chose the name Azure. Three main pillars, three distinct components: Windows Azure, SQL Azure, and Windows Azure App Fabric. In Windows Azure, we can have storage, we can have compute power, running applications, and we can have some management to configure the storage and the management of our compute environment. Next to that, we have SQL Azure, our database, relational database. A lot of tools are there, and we have some management environment. And underneath, we have the Windows Azure App Fabric. App Fabric contains Service Bus. I will explain that later in more detail, and access control. Important to remember is you can use one of those aspects alone if you want to. You don't have to go for the full platform. If you only want the SQL Azure, you only want the SQL Azure. If you only want to use Service Bus, there is no need for SQL, there is no need for a Windows Azure platform for hosting applications. You can use only the Service Bus. So you can pick which technology you want. All right, just a little background, the Fabric Controller. Fabric Controller is a technology that you will not see, because the Fabric Controller is a technology that is running inside the Microsoft data center. The Fabric is actually a list of machines, physical hardware. You have seen the pictures of the containers containing literally thousands of computers. Well, we call it the Fabric. A lot of computers, a lot of servers in one big network. And then we have the Fabric Controller. The Fabric Controller is a piece of software running inside the data center that communicates with every physical server in the Fabric. And it interacts. It interacts with a Fabric agent, a little piece of software running on the virtual machine inside the physical machine, and it interacts with each machine. And the reason why he does this is he wants to monitor the virtual machine application and all the instances that you have selected. So you see the Fabric Controller does the service management. It looks if a machine is down, it will replace it. Well, it will not replace it, it will move the applications to another machine. If you have a problem with some storage node, it will move the storage to another node and inform the load balancer that the storage has been moved. So load balancing and checkpointing what is happening is really the most important task of the Fabric Controller. So this runs inside the data center. We don't see it, but it is there to help us build high available, scalable applications. Next part are the roles. We are application developers, and we want to run applications in a virtual machine. And we as a developer, as an architect, can select, well, how many cores do we need for that virtual machine? 1, 2, 4, 8. We can make that decision ourselves. We also can have multiple instances of the virtual machine running. That's also a decision that we make ourselves. Well, there are actually two kinds of roles. The web role, which is internet facing. It is based on a request response pattern. We deploy ASP.NET applications and WCF services. And on the other hand, we have worker roles. Worker roles are a very classical type of service. It's background processing. It's an endless loop that is reading messages from a queue. It has some internal endpoints, but it can also host our WCF services. So exactly what is a service? In Azure, we see a new definition of the term service. Well, a service is actually a combination of X number of web roles and X number of worker roles. And all those worker roles, they can access certificates, for instance. Certificate to create HTTPS traffic is also part of our service. But what's typical about web roles and worker roles, they can run instances. An instance, well, you select it for yourself, is the same as the previous instance, but you have two machines. And for every worker role, for every web role that you create, you can select a different number of instances. Right? So what's next? The web-facing part, the web role, has some external endpoints. Every web role inside a service has an external endpoint. By default, this will be port 80 to have our browsers. Our browsers can access port 80, of course, but it can also be another port. And if you want to use HTTPS, we will be running on another port. Then you see that the worker roles, well, they are not internet-facing. They are just inside our service, and they can be reached, for instance, by internal endpoints. We have internal endpoints compared to external endpoints. Internal endpoints are also WCF services. It is SOAP. It is a REST protocol that we can use internally inside the service. So nobody on the internet can reach the endpoints that we configure on our worker role if we don't want that. They are for internal use. So this is a service. X number of web roles, X number of worker roles, endpoints internally and externally. Azure services are also talking to a storage environment. This is outside the storage, outside the service. A storage can be blobs, tables, and queues. But here you see, well, it's not in the same area. Services are decoupled from their storage. This also means we can have storage without services. We can have services without storage. And if our service goes down, our storage is still there. All the data is inside that storage. So we have a central storage in which each instance of our web or worker role can have access to. It stays alive even if we reboot our instances, or if Microsoft decides to reboot our instances. Yeah. So we have some storage environment. We can also have SQL Azure as a database. But we also use the storage for performance counters, for our log files from our application, for event logs, for the IIS log files, for crash dumps. That's why we also use storage for. Okay. Well, underneath the service, there is configuration. We need to configure services. Two levels of configuration. First, we call it a service configuration, and we also have a service definition. Service definition is different from service configuration because service definition really defines our services at deployment time. We make a decision how big the VM must be. 4 cores, 8 cores, so much storage, and so on, and so on. Service configuration is different because service configuration really defines number of instances, for instance, and maybe the thumbprint to a certificate. So the service configuration can be maintained after deploying. Service definition is defined when we deploy. Yes? Okay, let's talk a little bit about the NLB load balancer. You have seen the web role, they have external facing endpoints, while the load balancer will be in between your web browsers and your instances. What the load balancer does, it will just forward your request from the internet to one of the instances. It goes to one instance, and then maybe in the same session, maybe the same user in the same browser session, Well, it can now go to a second instance. So you're working actually in a kind of farm. Multiple instances are running behind the load balancer, and the load balancer decides to give every call, every instance, a few of those messages, a few of the requests. So we're talking here about a round-robin principle, which also means we have no sticky sessions. Very important to understand as an architect, our instances, our code in our instance, should be stateless. Because the round-robin principle will just one by one give the request to one of the instances, and if they have stored memory inside their instance, well, we have a problem. So there is no sticky sessions. Okay. Queues. Queues is a very important new topic in architecture, in cloud architecture. What do we do with queues? Well, they can be used for communication from web roles to work roles. This is one example. We can use queues wherever we want. We can use even queues from on-premises to on-premises through the cloud. But a very typical scenario for queues is we have web roles communicating to work roles in an asynchronously way. So one of the instances will put a message in the queue, and one of the work roles will get the message out. Well, which one of the work roles will get the message out? Well, it depends on which work role is free. A work role is an endless loop, and if it's doing nothing at that moment, he will get the message. All the other instances of the work roles which are busy at the moment will keep on being busy, but only the one which is free will get the message. One and only one work role, one instance of the work role will get the message. More examples, more detail in a few moments. I also talked about internal endpoints. Also here, internal endpoints can be used for many scenarios, but one typical scenario is, again, we have communication from the web role to the work role. An internal endpoint is a WCF endpoint, or a REST-based endpoint. While instances, if they are running inside the web role, can decide on which instance of the work role they can target. So it's different from working with the queues. With queues, it's only the one which is free at that moment that will get the communication and will get the message. If we're talking about internal endpoints, we have the decision based on the web role. The web role can decide, I'm going to this instance of my work role. Why is that? Because if you're talking about internal endpoints, they all have the same address, but they have a different port number for all the instances inside my work role. Well, it's an internal address, and from the outside, we don't see that address, but it's the same address for every instance. It only has a different port number, and we can target the port number that we want. And because we're running inside a service, inside the concept of a service, you see the gray box is my service, we have X number of web roles and X number of worker roles, they know about each other. A worker role can ask the service runtime environment, he can ask through some code, through some API, are there any endpoints inside the same service? And the storage runtime will tell you, well, there are more than one instance, and they have endpoints, and the address of that endpoint is the address that you are looking for, and that's the port number. So this is a very important concept you have to understand. You are not only deploying virtual machines, or more than one virtual machine, you're deploying something which is called a service. And a service is a combination of web roles, work roles, queues, endpoints, and you configure them as one unit. There's one unit of administration of configuring. And every participant in the service can know which are all the other participants, which endpoints, which queues that they're using, and so on. Okay? That was about compute power, hosting applications. Let's talk about storage. I'm not talking about SQL, because this is another topic. I'm just talking about Azure storage. Well, on Azure storage, we have nearly unlimited storage. There's no limit of 50 gigabytes. But we have unlimited storage. What we can store in that environment, well, there are four types of storage. Tables. And tables are not comparable to SQL tables because they are not relational. They have no predefined schema. They have no relations. They're just some XML files, for instance. Yeah. Then we have blobs, binary large objects. They have metadata attributes. They can store MIME types, so the browser knows what to do with the blob once it's downloaded. Could be a movie, could be a PDF file, I don't know. Very large objects. Queues, I told you already about the queues. Asynchronously communication from web to work role is one of the typical scenarios that we use queues for. Number four, a very interesting one, drives. Drives is an NTFS volume that can be mounted to your worker role. More detail in that later. And all the storage components are just accessible through HTTP REST or with a .NET client library, you can also do that. But even non-.NET environments, if they can use HTTP and REST calls, they can access tables, blobs, queues, drives. All right. More detail on tables. Tables typically have a partition key and a row key, a timestamp, and then some custom fields. We use the timestamp for concurrency, to see whether a record was updated while you were reading it, just concurrency problems to solve. Partition key and row key, those together form one unique ID of your record in your table. While tables are partitioned with a partition key to support load balancing across storage nodes. Let me explain that in detail. Let's have a look at this example. Three records, partition A, 1-3, partition A, 1-4, partition B, key 1-3, and then some data. While the Microsoft Data Center will use the partition, the field partition key, to divide across multiple storage nodes. So partition A will go to one storage node, and partition B will go to another storage node. So if it contains a huge amount of data, you can get really performant if you know the partition key in your queries. So if you're doing a query, I want to have some records somewhere out of my table storage, it is very much faster if you know the partition key compared to if you only know the row key. So very important to design your schema is thinking about partitioning. At the moment you do partitioning, you're also influencing your performance in your queries. So you have to think in advance of your partition key because they can be placed on different storage nodes. And if you know the partition key, he only knows that he has to go to that storage node and not to another one. If you're not specifying the partition key, well, he has to loop through all the partitions. Yes? So there are some patterns, some design patterns to do your table storage, to use your partitioning. Messages, we have a partition key in our structure. We have to make advantage of that for performance reasons. Okay. Blobs. What about blobs? Blobs can contain large data. They can be made private. They can also be made public. Blobs can have metadata attributes, so not only storing a very large movie, but I can also add some name value pairs to that. And I can also influence the MIME types. So I influence their behavior on the browser. Blobs can also be cached by a CDN. What is a CDN? A content delivery network. More on that later. Blobs can also have a time-based access. If we decide to create a public blob, and I only want to have that blob public for a certain amount of time, I can create a shared access signature. Two types of blobs, block blobs, page blobs. Well, the difference is page blob can store up to 1 terabyte. So one blob can be 1 terabyte. And page blobs are more useful for read and writing. They are optimized for reads and writes compared to block blobs. Block blobs are more optimized for streaming. So if the user wants a chunk of data, then another chunk of data, and so on, and I don't do any writes, I'm better off with block blobs. If I am very intensive on reading and writing at the same time, I can select for page blobs. Okay. And I also talked about drives. Drives are actually a very special kind of blobs, or they're actually page blobs. So we are using blobs to create a new storage component, which is called drives. So you see, well, we can store a drive of 1 terabyte for frequently random access, read and write, if we want. About accessibility, two scenarios. We have a private scenario, we have a public scenario. Private means, well, it is the cloud itself, our Azure applications running on the cloud, in our web role, in our work role, that can access the blobs. They need storage credentials for that. But if we're running public, we don't need any storage credentials. So we can make a container, which is a kind of subfolder in our blob environment. We can make a list of blobs, part of a container, can be made public. So we don't need any storage credentials. So blobs can also be used to host your web application, well, to host your website. Static content can also be hosted on blob storage. Every HTML file, every JPEG file, and so on, as long as there's no server-side code that must be run, I can store it in the blob container. So I don't need my services. Services are there to run code. Blob storage is there just to expose to the public via HTTP a lot of content. And that could be also HTTP, HTML pages. Yeah. So then we have the third option, semi-public. We're using time-based with shared access signatures. This means instead of going to the normal URL where my blob is present, I'm going to that URL with some extra signature, some GUID over here, some weird looking URL. But this is containing a kind of timestamp. And the blob storage on the other side knows, based on that timestamp, I'm going to show you that blob or not. So if the time is already passed, it will not show you that. It will just get you a 404 error. If it's not beyond that time frame, you will get the blob like you used to. Okay? Drives. Drives, like I said, was a special kind of blob storage. The idea about drives, or one of the typical scenarios about drives, is that you create your VHD drive from Windows 7 or from Windows Server 2008. You put your data on it. It's like normal file system. You mount it to a drive letter, and then you put some data on it. And then you upload the blob storage to the cloud. So you also uploaded it to Azure hosting, Azure storage. And then at that moment, your work roles or your web roles, which are already running in the data center, can mount the drive letter. So you can have on-premise a complete drive that you mount to your local file system. Then you write some data on it. You upload a complete drive as one big chunk of data. And it can be mounted back on the web or worker roles. Just a moment. I need some water. Excuse me for that. So what is your web and work role doing with that? Well, it will also get a drive letter. It will mount the drive, and it will have access to that files that are containing in that drive. So my legacy I/O code, everything that I want to do with a directory, everything that I want to do with creating files, reading files, changing files, will keep on working in the cloud. So I can port existing applications that are using my local file system. Well, I can use them also in the cloud after I upload it and drive also to the cloud and mount it to a drive letter inside my service. Right. So blobs, like I told you, can also be part of your content delivery network. Microsoft is also offering a CDN inside the Azure world. And what a CDN does is, well, it sits between your user and the data center. Well, there are more CDN nodes than there are actually data centers. In a data center, I can run my services, and I can host my blob storage. With a CDN node, I can only cache my blobs. There is no way to run services over there. So what is happening with the CDN network? The user will request my blob. He uses a certain URL to access my blobs. And the CDN node will look, well, do I got this blob here? Is that blob already cached here? If no, it knows how to find it on your blob storage. He downloads it, and he also gives it to the end user. So the end user doesn't know anything. He just sees the blob, your PDF file, your movies, your JPEG files, and so on. So the next time a user comes, could be another user, but maybe in the same geographical area. If the next user comes with another request, also for that blob, well, the CDN node knows, well, I already cached it. So I can give it to the end user. I don't have to go to my blob storage centrally to have that. Of course, there is a time to live. We can define how much time that the data can be, or the blob can be cached in the CDN node. That's something that a developer makes as a decision. Okay. Content delivery network, I've shown you here a list, only the European data centers. Azure data centers we currently have in Dublin and in Amsterdam. There we can run SQL Azure, there we can run our hosting, there we can run App Fabric, and so on and so on. And then we have the current CDN nodes, Amsterdam, Dublin, and so on. These can cache our blob storage, but not run applications. Okay, next element. I already talked a little bit about queues. I'm going to talk about queues more in detail now. What is queues? Well, very simple concept. Message in, message out. That's a queue. We can have a lot of messages in, and of course we need to read the messages out of again. So this is there to support our asynchronously processing model. Instead of having the end user waiting for several seconds, well, we can now just respond from our web roles directly to the customer, to the client, and we can just offload our process to some kind of work role in the background, which is there to read queues. A lot of topologies are possible, from cloud to cloud, from web role to work role, or even the other way around, also possible. From cloud to on-premises, the consumer of our messages can be running on-premises, or the creator of our messages can be run on-premises and the consumer in the cloud, or even both on-premises, and we just go through the cloud to send queues. What is exactly a queue? Well, a queue message is just a string of 8K. Nothing more, nothing less. We can serialize objects into 8K, and we can send some batches, some information to start the process. We can send it to the consumer of the queue. But then again, it's HTTP and REST-based. Everything in Azure, what you do with storage, is REST-based. So without any SOAP environment, you can access your queues, reading and writing. So how do queues work? We always have a message creator. We have a message reader. And inside there is a queue. A queue has a name. A queue contains some messages. So what is happening? Suddenly, somebody says, I want to get a message. Your work role can do that. Your on-premise application can do that. But what you see, the message is still in the queue. At the moment we say get message, our message is being read, but it is also inside the queue. It is still there. Next step we do is we process the message. We look at the content of the message and we do something. We start up a workflow. We store something in a database. We do something. But still the message is in the queue, but only visible for the instance of the work role that has read the queue. So if I have multiple instances that are doing a get message, well, one of them will get it, and the other ones don't. So it's kind of a lease system. And the message is there only for one instance of your worker role. So, okay, then we do the processing of the message. We do a lot of stuff. What we need to do is we need to delete the message. So it's kind of a transactional system. We're going to tell to the queuing environment, actually to the fabric controller, that we have succeeded with processing our message, and we delete the message. So what happens if we delete the message? Then the message is outside the queue. It's not there anymore. So it cannot be delivered to any other instance. So this is a new way of thinking, a new kind of transactional system. We read something, and we can be sure that we're the only one that has read it, but then we have to be responsible to create a decision and to say, well, delete it. So my processing is finished. I'm happy with it. so delete it from the queue. So what happens if you don't delete it? If you do not delete the message, well, the message is still in the queue, but it will be appended at the bottom of the queue. Okay. And maybe some other instance of your worker role, or maybe the same instance of your worker role, after a few moments in time, will read the message again. Okay. So the idea is reading messages, doing processing, and then just giving a signal to the environment, I'm finished, you can delete the message. If it's not deleted, it will be keep on running inside your queues. Yeah? All right. Okay, that was about Azure queues. What about Azure management? How can we manage Azure? Azure hosting, Azure SQL storage, and so on. Everything is REST-based, like I told you. We have some management API, and we have some diagnostics API. Management APIs are there to deploy or to do an upgrade, to configure everything that we want, and of course to scale up or scale down. The management API allows us to add more instances. It will not scale by itself. There is no generic scaling approach available. You have to do it yourself. You have to read some performance metrics, and based on the performance metrics, you make a decision, and then you scale out. Then you scale to more instances. Yes? Diagnostics API is there to read the metrics. We can set up performance counters. We can configure logging. We can also schedule the log transfers. Because the problem is, you don't have remote access to your virtual machines, at least not in this version of Azure. So everything that your application does, every log file, every event, every information that you want to see from your application should be logged, and then you should schedule some transfers of that logging. And logging is also stored in Azure storage. So after that, you can download it and do some research on your logging, performance counters, and so on. Yes. So everything REST-based, two main APIs. Besides that, we have the management portal. If everything is good with the internet, I will show you the management portal in a moment. It is just a web-based portal, HTML-based, to configure everything. You can deploy, upgrade, you can create namespaces for your app fabric, you can do whatever you want in the portal. The portal is coupled to your Live ID account. So the credentials to log in into the portal are a Live ID account. Yes? Okay. Let's say you want to do your management not through a web browser, but locally. Well, there is a snap-in, an MMC snap-in, especially made for Azure. So you can do it like a traditional way. Without going to a browser, you just open MMC, you add a snap-in, and you see everything which is running inside your data center. A lot of things are also done by PowerShell commandlets. Adding instances, removing instances, swapping from production to staging and from staging to production, creating upgrades, also can be done by PowerShell commandlets. So this is the very heart of the Azure management. Okay, the very heart is HTTP REST APIs, but on top of that we have commandlets, we have PowerShell commandlets. About Azure management, we also see a lot of third-party tools already. So not only Microsoft is giving you tools to configure your Azure environment, a lot of companies are just making tools publicly available at a very low cost. All right, before we go to SQL Azure, I will just show you the management portal. I already logged in, Windows Azure, nice big logo. What I have here is a button to add a new service. I can add storage account, and I can add hosted services. Let's start with hosted services. Just hope that we get a speedy connection here. I am having some problems here with the internet connection. Okay. So I'm creating a service, just providing a label, just some demo with a service description demo. I click next. And on the next page, he's asking me several items that are needed to provision the service. I'm creating a hosted service, so the URL of the hosted service will be cloudapp.net, and then something on front of that. So I have control over the name of my application, but of course, blah, 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 .cloudapp.net will not be used to go to my end user. I can create a DNS seed name record to make an alias from something I decide for myself towards this address, blah, 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 .cloudapp.net. Okay, I decided on the URL. Then I can also decide on the location. Where do I want to host my services? In Asia, which would be Singapore. In the US, you know, 4 different data centers in the US. In Europe, Dublin or Amsterdam. I can also select affinity groups. Affinity groups are there to make combinations of multiple services inside one logical unit. So if you move them in the future from one data center to another data center, all the ones in the same affinity group will be moved together. So you have some control over multiple services also. Okay, let's create a service here. I'm going to use montil.cloudapp.net. Create. Now he's checking if that domain name is still available. I hope it is. Did I already press the create button? I hope so. Okay, select a region. Let's say I'm going for Northern Europe. And then I press the create button again. So now he's creating an empty service. He's not asking me for a deployment. He's just creating an empty service. I need to wait here. All right. Still working. You see my affinity group, you see my location. And then I have 2 environments. If I press the deploy button here, he's asking me for a package that is compiled by Visual Studio, or I can do it the other way. From Visual Studio, I can just push my package to that environment. Many, many scenarios are possible. But you see 2 environments, production and staging. Production will be running on the URL that I have defined. Staging will be running on some kind of secret URL, only for your testing environment. What I can do with production and staging is I can make a swap. It's literally some seconds, maybe 30 or 40 seconds that it takes to swap staging from production. So if I have version 1 in production and I'm deploying version 2 in staging, after that, my testers have said, well, everything is okay. You can put version 2 in production. I go to the portal, and I switch them. So what is happening is he's just telling to the load balancer, to the network load balancing, well, the 2 environments have switched. They're both running, but if a user request comes into the URL, to the public URL, you don't have to send it to version 1. You're sending it to version 2, just a swap of the 2 services. It's not a swap of the virtual machine, it's a swap of the complete service. Remember, a service is X number of web roles, X number of worker roles. Yes? So that was about creating a service, well, a compute service. Going to show you how to create a storage service. Okay, storage account. You also see a number of services I have remaining. I made a provisioning of my Azure account here with a credit card. And then you have a number of services that you can use. So again, I'm creating a label for that service. And then he's asking me again for some domain name. And that domain name will be blah, 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 .blob.core.windows.net. And again, I can select the region. And that's all I have to do. At that moment, let's create one. I will get a password. I will get a user ID. Well, the user ID will be Montil, because I decided that my storage name is Montil. Well, then also my user will be Montil. So now he's creating for me 3 places in the data center, 1 for blobs, 1 for tables, and 1 for queues. You see Montil.blob, Montil.queue, Montil.table. And I have some access keys, which are the passwords to use to access that storage. You see, we have two keys. So this means you can have different people with their own key having access to your storage. So you can regenerate the keys. If you say, well, my key is not useful anymore, somebody knows it that shouldn't know it, you can regenerate the key. Yeah? So that was about creating storage. Now let's also continue and create a SQL Azure database. And then I will continue with some content on SQL databases. So within the same portal, I can select create me a SQL server. I have to accept the terms of use. And the next thing he asked me is, well, give me an administrator username, give me an administrator password, and also some location. So my administrator username is Montil admin, and then some password. Has to be very secure, just a moment. Has to be a very strong password, I mean. So this is even not okay. I hope this one is. Select the location, Northern Europe again. Create a server. And now within a few seconds, I have my SQL server. I have some master database in my SQL server, and I can create my own databases. First of all, I need to define some firewall settings. Two types of firewall settings, one checkbox which is allowing me Microsoft services to access this database. If I check it, while my services, my web roles and my work roles running inside the same Azure project will have access to my database. Nobody else, only my services, my web roles, work roles that I've created inside the same service. If I want to have access from outside the Azure Data Center, I need to add some rule, which is an IP range that I have to give. So I have to give a name and some IP ranges. Those are the ones that can access my SQL database. Of course, they need the username and password that I have given as an administrator, but I can also create logins and users inside the database that I'm using. So every database can have its own set of users and its own set of credentials, roles, and so on. So my server is ready. How to create a database is also very simple. Create a database and then select the type or the size. I can go to 50 gigabytes. So if I do this, create. Now I have a database of 50 gigabytes. Did you already have done that, creating a database of 50 gigabytes in your company within a few seconds? That's why Azure is very important for you. So this is the demo about SQL Azure. Let's talk about more about the content of SQL Azure. So like I told, it's a relational database in the cloud based on SQL 2008 or 2. It is accessible from any ADO.NET client. It uses the same wire protocol as your on-premises SQL server. We're going to use the SQL 2008 R2 Management Studio. And of course, it has high availability and fault tolerance built-in. No physical administration. You don't do backups and restores. You don't patch your operating system or your SQL server. You don't run scripts to do something. It is just there as a service. You have a database, you store your data in it. Existing knowledge as a T-SQL developers are still useful. They're going to work with the same store procedures, triggers, scripts, and so on. Every tool that you use on-premises is also usable in the cloud. I'm thinking about BCP, bulk copy. If I want to do bulk copy into the cloud, I use the bcp.exe tool, while I can do the same. Scale databases up and down, I can change the amount of data that I have provisioned. If I selected 10 gigabytes, and I don't need the 10 gigabytes in my database anymore, I can say, well, change it to 5 gigabytes. Or also the other way around. If I started with 1 gigabyte, I can go up and up and up until I reach 50 gigabytes. Well, in steps of 1, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. And also, this also depends my price. My price is influenced by the decision. How large is my database, of course? Yes. Maybe important to know about pricing is that everything is based pro rata. So if you don't use it for a day, you're not paying for that day. But there is another principle in SQL Azure about pricing is that if you provision a database with a maximum capacity of, let's say, 40 gigabytes, and your database is only a half gigabyte, well, you will pay only for 10 gigabytes. He's rounding to the nearest cap. So if I'm selecting a business website, a business database, which is ranging from 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, if I select it must grow to 40, it will not grow beyond 40. But if I only have, like say, 9 gigabytes in that database, I will only pay 10 gigabytes. If I store 11 gigabytes in that same database of 40 gigabytes, I pay 20. 31 is 40, 29 is 30. You see? So a very interesting pay-as-you-grow model also here in SQL Azure. So what is SQL Azure again? Just a combination of the master database and one or more gigabytes of database storage. So I can create as many databases as I want, and I can select for every database 1 gigabyte until 50 gigabytes or something in between. Logins are inside my master database. Users and their roles are inside my database. So this means I cannot use at this wave, at this version of Azure, we cannot use Active Directory authentication. And there are SQL logins, and we need to have a SQL password. But I can create for every customer that is using my database, I can create a user and place them in some roles. Two workloads, two scenarios. Azure services can use my database, and we call it code near. And my code is very near to my database inside the same data center. Or if I'm using restricted IP ranges, I can allow anybody to access my database, which is also known as code far. My code is somewhere running on a fat client somewhere, and my database is in the cloud. Okay. Stored on three replicas. Like I told you before, every bit that you send to a SQL server is stored on three physical machines. You don't see those three different machines. You only see one connection, but you can store data in it. And the Microsoft Data Center will store that on three replicas. So if a machine with your SQL server goes down, there are two others waiting to take over. Well, that distribution system, that load balancing system, you don't have to configure that yourself. It's there out of the box. Only one database, 50 gigabytes, you have three different machines, three different replicas where your data is. What else very important as a database architect? We have something which is called quorum commit in SQL Azure. What is a quorum commit? Well, it's a principle that says we're only going to commit, we're only going to define that something is committed if a primary and one secondary replica has received a transaction, has received the data, update, insert, delete, and so on. So this means the database, well, I write to my database, but the Azure environment will write it to two replicas and also to a third one. But it means if we have two replicas that I'm saying, okay, I have received your bit of data, it is safely secure stored on my machine, and if two of them say, okay, this is true, then we consider it as a commit. Yes. Don't worry about it. You don't have to do anything for that. It's out of the box available when you're using SQL Azure. Okay? Committed. So that was the discussion about SQL Azure. Next moving part was AppFabric. AppFabric Service Bus. Well, first we called it Service Bus, we called it Azure Service Bus, and then they decided to give it another name, AppFabric, because we also have a technology on-premises, Windows Server 2008 AppFabric, which at this moment is still another technology, maybe the same purposes, but a different technology. Well, in the future, you will see that they will migrate to each other. They will have the same goal in mind: App Fabric on the Windows Server and Azure App Fabric. So what is Azure App Fabric? It's the technology to connect applications on services and cloud, and on services in the cloud or on premises. We're going to expose our application and our services through firewalls, through network address translation environments. Very easy. The service bus really acts as a relay between WCF services somewhere and clients somewhere. And with somewhere, I mean literally somewhere. They can be running on my machine here. They can be running on a Windows phone. They can be running on the cloud, on an Azure data center. And we can also reuse REST and SOAP, so they can also run our services and clients maybe in another technology on another operating system. Everything is SOAP-based, REST-based. Also very useful to know, App Fabric supports the pub/sub pattern. This means I'm a publisher, and I will send some data to the App Fabric, and I have one or more subscribers that are interested in that data. And at the moment they subscribe, they are added to a list somewhere in the cloud. And at the moment I send some data to that fabric, the App Fabric, it will distribute it to all that was subscribed. Pub/sub is very important. So how does it work? The Azure App Fabric is somewhere in the cloud. We define a namespace, like a URL. And mycompany.servicebus.net. And then we have some clients somewhere running WCF, some services somewhere WCF. Here in this picture, you see them running on premises, but they can run wherever they want. Well, the service, which is a WCF service, will say to the service bus on the cloud, well, here I am. I have an address, publish me. And that address will not be some kind of local address, local IP address of my machine, but it will be kind of virtual address. An address which is only known by the App Fabric. It's not HTTP, well, it is HTTP, but it doesn't start with a prefix HTTP, it starts with the prefix SB, service bus. And service bus prefixes are known by the App Fabric. So the service tells to the App Fabric, well, I'm here. Of course, he has to give some credentials. He has to log in into the service bus network and then publish itself into the cloud, into the App Fabric. Well, then the client knows that virtual address. He doesn't know the physical address, but he knows the address that was used when the service has started provisioning itself into the cloud. And he says, I want to use your service. I'm a WCF client, and I want to use your endpoints. Well, instead of going directly to that physical location, because he doesn't know the physical location, he's going to the cloud. He's going to App Fabric with credentials or without credentials. There are two options. And he's asking to the cloud, do you know anybody that has provisioned himself as being that address? And then the cloud, the App Fabric, will tell, okay, there was one, and I'm going to relay every communication, every SOAP message, back and forth from your client to the service. Could be REST, could be SOAP, security, without security, HTTP binding, different types of bindings. The cloud will just relay them. It will not store the messages, but it will just relay every information from client to server. And in between the client and your App Fabric environment, and between the App Fabric and your service, there could be some firewall. There could be some hardware that does the network address translation. Well, you don't care about it. It's the App Fabric technology that will solve the problem for you. You as an architect or as a developer, you just keep on coding in WCF, and it will run on the App Fabric. Don't be worried about firewalls and so on. Okay, there is also some fourth step in that service-based relaying concept. Clients and services can communicate also peer-to-peer. We call it a direct protocol. Well, they need only the App Fabric as a handshake, as a rendezvous point, to know each other, to know the physical address of the consumer. And then the App Fabric can tell to the client, well, this is the physical address of that consumer or that service. Now you can start communicating with each other, and you don't need me anymore. This is optional. You don't have to go so far in that pattern. You can also work with relaying, but you can also start with relaying for the handshake and then do a direct peer-to-peer communication between client and service. That's also possible. Yes. That was about service bus. I think this is a very useful pattern, very useful technology. And you don't need services to do your routing yourself. And you don't need to run applications to do that. It is just there out of the box in App Fabric. You configure a namespace. You download some SDK, which are additional libraries that you need to run your applications. Or you can do it on REST-based APIs, also possible. Okay. Let's continue with the last part of this walkthrough. Access control, also part of the App Fabric, Azure App Fabric Access Control. Access control is there to help you build federated authorization. And you can use it for application and services on premises, in the cloud, or any other topology. It's all about rules and claims. A claim is just some proof that you have given correct credentials to an identity provider, and then you can go with that claim, which is just a binary stream of bytes, and you can give that to some application, and you can log in into the application with the claim. The idea about access control is that it supports many, many different identity management infrastructures. One typical example of an identity management infrastructure is our Active Directory. Another one is Live ID. One is running on premises, the one is also running on the web. Well, it can bridge the identity stores, like for instance using ADFS version 2, Active Directory Federation Services, we can use that to bridge our on-premises authentication model, to bridge the logins towards our services in the cloud, which are using Windows Identity Framework, also known as Geneva. A few months ago we talked about Geneva, now we have Windows Identity Framework. Okay, what's the story about access control? We have a client and a service, of course, can be running in whatever topology we need. We have the access control service. Well, part of the access control service is the App Fabric. And another part of the access control service, and the little box on the right side, is Active Directory. So they're working together. So your service needs to trust the access control service. So this is the first action in a federated scenario. The service running somewhere outside my Active Directory domain, the service doesn't know the users, he doesn't know how to authenticate the users, he has no idea about roles defined in Active Directory or somewhere else. The service is just a service which is using Geneva, Windows Identity Framework. Well, the first thing the service has to do is, well, it has to give some trust to the access control service. The way we expose the trust is by giving it an X509 certificate. There are two options. The service will give the X509 certificate to the access control service, or the other way around, the access control service, in combination with ADFS version 2, will read the X509 certificate from the service. So once that trust is established, then we can continue with some functional logic. Maybe the client wants to go to the service. And instead of giving its username and password to the service, he knows, well, it's not useful to give my username and password to the service because the service doesn't know my username and password. We cannot expect that the service can maintain all the usernames and passwords and all the different types of authentication. So that's why we use federated identity. So the client will ask to the service, and the question will be asked in some SOAP format. It's based on WS Trust and other technologies inside the WS specifications. On what condition am I allowed to use your functionality? And the service will say, well, for instance, you need to be 18 years old to talk to my service. I am a website, and you can order beer through my website. While in this stage, you have to be 18 years old or 21, I don't know, to order a beer on a website. While the client knows, well, it's not useful to go to the service anymore, I'm going to authenticate myself to an access control service. And watch out, this step, step number four, can also be done before the other steps are starting, because I'm logging in at the morning into my Active Directory. I logged in into my Active Directory, and a few moments later, I start working with a web application. So I'm already authenticated into that environment. So the access control service can work with Active Directory, can work with Windows Live ID, card spaces, or physical certificates, a lot of authentication mechanisms. So after a positive authentication, maybe the access control service is a service which is run by the government, and I used my Identiteitskaart, my ID, my digital ID, to log in, and the government can say, well, now I give you a claim because I know you're more than 18 years, and he's giving you the claim. And that claim goes back to the client, and that claim, very important, is signed by the certificate that my service has given to the access control service. So next step is that my claim goes to my service. And instead of username and password, now the claim goes to the service. And now the service can know, well, if I see somebody coming in with that claim, I can see that that claim was signed by my own certificate. Because before we started the whole conversation, I have given the certificate to the access control service, and it is signed by that particular certificate. So I know that he's 18 years old. I don't know his name. I don't know in which roles he's working. I don't know his password. That's good. I don't know his password, which is very good. I cannot maintain everybody's password in a cloud environment. So I'm using access control services. Yeah? So App Fabric Access Control is the technology to do the federated identity. It works together with Active Directory, can work together with Windows Live ID, can work together with OAuth, which is an open protocol to do identity management, and so on. Okay. That was the last part of the complete set of current technologies inside Azure. So we discovered hosting, we discovered storage, SQL Azure, Service Bus, and access control. So what about the future? Azure is here for a few months, years already. Are we thinking about new releases? Well, of course. You will see that Azure will now be entering into the infrastructure as a service. Everything we have seen before was all based about platforms, applications, running applications. Now we see we're going to the infrastructure as a service space. What we will see in the future is VM roles. And we talked about web roles and worker roles. Now we're also going to see VM roles. VM role is your own custom tailored virtual machine that you can host on Azure, based on the same business value of cloud economics, pay as you grow, pay for use, and so on. In the future. What we also see is that there are going to be more options to configure your web and work roles for IT pro tasks. Startup scripts when my machine is booting, configuration of IIS, for instance, to supposed host headers, and so on. And also very important new technology, Bart already mentioned it in his keynote, Project Sydney. It has nothing to do with the capital of Australia or with some city in Australia. It is just called Project Sydney. What is Project Sydney? It's the integration between Active Directory on-premises and in the cloud. It's kind of VPN secure tunnel between your local on-premises AD and applications running in the cloud. So this can mean you can create some logic inside your cloud applications that is relying on Active Directory. Okay, this is based again on Geneva, Windows Identity Framework, access control, and so on. But also think about the other way, and that was the example that Bart was showing you. From within the cloud, we can access our local printers, because our local printers are behind Active Directory credentials. Well, if we integrate our applications in the cloud with a secure VPN tunnel towards Active Directory on-premises, we can succeed in printing from the cloud to your local machines. Okay. So remember Project Sydney, integration Active Directory premises on cloud, VPN tunnels, central management, working with Active Directory in the cloud. This is a little roadmap of the future. Within a little month, 28th of October, there is PDC, Professional Developer Conference. They will have a lot of more details, demos, content on the roadmap for the next few months, next few years. Okay?